Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, I'm Libby, and I'll be reading you today's Cape Cod Times, dated Friday, March 15th, 2024. We've got rain in today's weather outlook. It will be mostly cloudy with a couple of showers throughout the day with highs in the mid-50s. Tonight, mostly cloudy. Temperatures will go back into the 30s. Saturday will be times of clouds and sun. And Sunday, the rain will return. Highs over the weekend will be in the high 40s to low 50s. By special request from a few of our faithful listeners, we now present the lottery numbers. For Thursday's numbers game midday drawing, we have numbers 7, 9, 2, and 2. Thursday's evening drawing numbers were 7, 1, 5, and 2. For Thursday's mass cash drawings, we have number 2, 11, 12, 22, and 23. For Wednesday's Powerball drawing, the numbers were 21, 29, 54, 59, 62, and the extra ball of number 4. And finally, for Tuesday's Mega Millions drawing, the numbers were 2, 16, 31, 57, 64, and the extra ball of 24. The lead story on page 1 of today's newspaper is headlined, A Different Breed. Robot Dog Helped Bring Hyena's Standoff with Police to a Peaceful End, by Walker Armstrong of the Cape Cod Times. After the Massachusetts State Police sent a robotic dog into the house of a Hyena's man during a 7-hour standoff last week, the man, who periodically fired at police, shot and damaged the mechanical canine known as Spot. Boston Dynamics, the Waltham-based manufacturer of the canine robot, said it was the first instance globally of a robot in the field being shot at and damaged. "Yeah, this is a unique situation. We haven't had this happen before," said Brendan Schulman, vice president of policy and government relations at Boston Dynamics. "Obviously, we're very supportive of our public safety customers, and we're delighted that the robot helped keep people safe by being placed in harm's way as a machine rather than a person." On March 6th, state police sent the robotic dog into the house of Justin Morera, age 30, during the standoff in an attempt to locate and convince him to come out of the house peacefully. Authorities said Morera, who was armed and had fired on police, shot at the robot, partially disabling it. Police later found 37 shell casings from 3 different firearms at the crime scene. Police later took Morera into custody without injury. He is being held at the Barnstable County Correctional Facility and was arraigned on Thursday in Barnstable District Court. According to the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office, he is scheduled to appear at a probable cause hearing on April 4th. The state police did not respond to 3 emails and 1 phone message from the Times requesting comment. The many uses of Spot the robot dog. Boston Dynamics spokesperson Carrie Nealon said there are thousands of spots in the field, many of which are used for industrial purposes, such as power plant and factory inspections. But she said various law enforcement agencies and first responders use them. Spot helps keep people out of harm's way and aids first responders in assessing dangerous situations, Nealon said. Specific applications include things like hazardous gas detection, unexploded ordnance inspection, suspicious package investigation, search and rescue, subterranean or confined space exploration, and structural assessments following fires, disaster events, and other hazards. Last year, during a parking garage collapse in Manhattan, the New York City Fire Department used a Spot robot to enter the collapsed structure in an attempt to search for anyone trapped. The robot found one person who was dead, Schulman said. That enabled rescuers to avoid sending workers into an unstable, collapsed structure because there was no one to rescue, he said. This is a clear example of sending a machine rather than a person into a dangerous environment. In Los Angeles, a spot robot was used during a standoff where the suspect had dropped his firearm. The robot relayed footage of the discarded firearm to officers on the scene, and the police were able to apprehend the individual. In another incident in St. Petersburg, Florida, a man had kidnapped a 3-year-old and was driving away in a truck when he crashed on the highway. Shulman said police used the spot robot to approach the truck before officers did to see if the man had a gun. Using that streaming video, the officials determined that there was no firearm, and they could then approach the vehicle, and they rescued the child unharmed, Shulman said. How much does a canine robot cost? According to news reports, a spot robot can cost between $80,000 and $278,000, depending on the configurations the customers require. Shulman said they do not disclose the exact cost of spot robots because they vary on a case-by-case basis, but their policy is strict in outlining what they can and cannot be used for. We've been very proactive from the beginning of our commercial sales process to prohibit the weaponization of spot or the use of the robot to harm or intimidate any person or animal, he said. Recently, State Representative Lindsay Sabadosa, a Democrat from Northampton, and Senator Michael Moore, a Democrat from Millbury, filed a bill that would ensure advanced robots are used responsibly by prohibiting the manufacture and purchase of such technology outfitted with a weapon. Shulman said he testified in support of the bill in November. And it's very important because we want to make sure that as the robots are introduced into places where people live and work, that everyone understands that they're here to do good things for people, to protect lives, and there's no reason to be alarmed about them, Shulman said. Healy, first in nation blanket pardon for misdemeanor marijuana, by Kinga Barandi of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. Drawing on her state's deep commitment to advancing justice and social equity in Massachusetts, Governor Maura T. Healy issued a blanket pardon for all misdemeanor marijuana convictions in the state in perpetuity. It's about time. The president did it. Now it's time for our state to do it, Healy said as she announced the executive order. It is effective immediately, pending the approval of the governor's council, which meets March 27th. Member Paul DiPaolo, representing Worcester and Central Massachusetts, said he expects the item to be on the agenda that day. I can't speak for other members of the council, but I'm enthusiastic about this, DiPaolo said. Once the council acts, the pardon will be effective immediately. Massachusetts is the first state in the nation to take action since the president pardoned federal marijuana convictions and called on states to follow, Healy said. President Joe Biden announced the pardon of federal marijuana convictions in Washington, D.C. during his more than hour-long State of the Union address on March 7th. The executive order pardoning the conviction is within the powers of the governor and is different from an expungement, which would wipe the slate clean for affected persons. Healy estimates that hundreds of thousands of residents would be affected by the pardon that is automatic, with no action required by individuals. Residents can request and receive a certificate of pardon after filling out an online form. It's a question, she intimated, of updating criminal records. Massachusetts decriminalized marijuana possession in 2008 and legalized it in 2016 through ballot initiatives, asking residents to decide the issue. Since then, the state has been home to a $1 billion recreational and medicinal use marijuana industry, growing, producing, and selling the substance in stores throughout the state. Healy, who as Attorney General initially opposed the measures, has now embraced its legal status in Massachusetts and many other states around the nation. In 2022, while on the gubernatorial campaign trail, she pledged to pardon those convicted of simple possession in state courts. Federally, it is still considered a Schedule I substance, on par with heroin, opioids, and cocaine. When questioned on her changed stance, Healy said she had evolved. Who doesn't want a governor who can grow? The pardon, Healy said, would help redress the harm, the disparities in the state's criminal justice system that targeted Black and Brown populations. She quoted statistics about marijuana use across Black, Brown, and White populations. While use is statistically uniform across all populations, Black and Latino people are more likely to get arrested, charged, and convicted for possession than white people. Healy was joined on the grand staircase of the State House with Attorney General Andrea Joy Campbell, district attorneys from across the state, legislators, representatives from the law enforcement community, and other leaders who supported the measure, either through legislation or their advocacy. Lanny Kudikoff of Dedham, a criminal justice advocate for 45 years, applauded enthusiastically the governor's announcement. His organization, Coalition for Effective Public Safety, or SEPS, has worked to effect change for decades. The blanket pardon is a step in the right direction, he said, adding that it was a question that needed addressing with the changes in the state's marijuana laws. The pardon would break down barriers to securing jobs, housing, and educational benefits that a conviction could pose for marijuana possession. Having residents still living with a past conviction, a conviction for an offense that is not even currently a cause for arrest, didn't sit right with me, Healy said, quoting Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. saying, "It's always the right time to do the right thing." Clemency has been a cornerstone of the Healy-Driscoll administration, said the governor. It is a collective responsibility to advance justice and fairness in the state, Healy said. Representative Mary Keefe, a Democrat from Worcester, said the pardon is a big deal for many of the people in my district. Neighbors who 20 years ago made a choice and have had to live with the consequences for years. They may have been deflected from their dreams, may have attempted to hide that conviction. But, Keefe noted, those issues have a way of always coming to the fore. It, a conviction for marijuana possession, set many young people on a difficult trajectory, Keefe said. Keefe hopes the pardon will affect the state's CORI system, a criminal background check conducted by state agencies, especially schools and programs that work with children. Pardons could open the door to residents who wish to volunteer in their children's schools and programs. The pardon, Keefe said, could be life-changing for them, allowing and making a big difference for them. She hopes the matter is expedited and happens quickly for the affected residents of Massachusetts. Several marijuana entrepreneurs who were arrested on possession charges in their youth spoke after the governor Wednesday. Devin Alexander was riding around with friends as a teenager on February break when they were stopped by police. The only Black youth in the car, he was pulled out, and when the officer smelled marijuana, he was arrested and charged with possession of 3 grams of the substance. His plans to join the U.S. Air Force were derailed. All he ever heard was that he would never succeed, never amount to anything. No individual anywhere should be jailed for possession of marijuana, Alexander said, adding the pardon was the first step in the process of counteracting the effects of the racist war on drugs. Representative Sarah Peek, a Democrat from Provincetown, whose community just de-incentivized the arrest and prosecution of possession of natural drugs, including magic mushrooms, was a strong proponent of the measure. The story is repeated over and over again, Peek said. This measure will right an old wrong. Last of 5 lottery tickets purchased in Buzzards Bay is a $4 million winner, by Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. A sandwich man walked into Sam's food store in Buzzards Bay to buy gas one day, and walked out with enough money to retire and purchase a new house. James Leonard won the third $4 million prize in the Massachusetts State Lottery's $4 million Diamonds $10 instant ticket game, in which odds of winning are 1 in 4,032,000. He didn't know until he got home that he was a few scratches away from being a multimillionaire. That's right, Leonard won 400,000 times what he paid for the ticket, the last to be scratched of 5 $10 tickets he bought that afternoon at Sam's. Reached through his LinkedIn profile, business consultant Leonard thanked the Cape Cod Times for reaching out, but said he did not want to be interviewed. Leonard's LinkedIn profile describes him as lover of life, lifelong sales competitor, winner and contributor that exceeds quota, relentless new opportunity creator, focused on business outcomes. The lottery's website said Leonard bought the five tickets with the $50 proceeds of a ticket he bought the day earlier when he stopped for tonic water. According to the website, Leonard chose the cash option on his prize and received a one-time payment of $2.6 million before taxes. He said he plans to use his winnings to buy a new home and fund his retirement. Leonard purchased his winning ticket at Sam's Food Stores on Main Street in Buzzards Bay. The store receives a $40,000 bonus for its sale of this ticket. A few days after the sale, a clerk at the gas station and convenience store said employees didn't know who had won because the ticket was not scratched at the store. On January 16th, Paul Riley of Peabody and his dog Raven won the first $4 million prize in the game. Grocer signs lease at former Christmas Tree Shop store by Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times. An Aldi grocery store will be coming to Falmouth Plaza, to the one-time home of Christmas Tree Shops. Greg Bilizikian, who owns the plaza at 39 Davis Straits, announced on Wednesday that he had signed a 10-year lease with Aldi. The Germany-based grocery chain hopes to open the store by the summer. Aldi is one of the fastest-growing grocers in the country, according to the Wall Street Journal, adding about 100 stores per year in the last decade. With about 1,600 products on its shelves and 90% of the stock in private labels, the chain offers prices that are lower than the national averages. The State Department of Transportation requires changes related to access and parking, Bilizikian said. The shopping center was built in 1961, according to assessor's records. Some town and governmental rules and regulations need to be addressed before the store can open. The center hasn't been redeveloped since my parents took possession in the 1980s, he said. The 23,250 square foot store will offer a slimmed down number of staples, including bread, milk, and eggs. It's how Aldi keeps its prices low, according to the Journal's YouTube video. The company focuses its buying power on fewer products and deals directly with manufacturers. Aldi is a multinational company founded by brothers Carl and Theo Albrecht. Upon their deaths, the company was placed into a private family foundation. The company was the first to show interest in the location last June, Bilizikian said. It's been a long haul, he said. I think it's going to be a great addition to the neighborhood. Christmas Tree Shops, begun in Yarmouthport, expanded starting in the 1970s. Eventually opening locations in New England and New York. The stores were the go-to places for Christmas decorations and lights, paper plates and cups decorated for various holidays, home decoration knockoffs, beach gear, and linen and kitchen supplies. Christmas Tree Shops filed for bankruptcy in 2023. Since then, all store locations have been closed. There is a large photo of a woman holding a pie by a sign that says Pie Day, Pie Sale Orders Only. And the caption reads, Friday Club President Sue McGuire heads out of the kitchen Thursday in Yarmouthport with a key lime pie for a customer pickup at the club's annual Pie Day, Pie Sale. Key lime was the most popular choice of the day, a nod perhaps to St. Patrick's Day on Sunday. Pi is the mathematical constant equal to 3.14159, and the photo was by Steve Hazlip of the Cape Cod Times. Aegean Pizza must move due to property redevelopment plan by Zane Razek of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Hyannis. A longtime family-owned Hyannis delivery and takeout restaurant is on the hunt for a new home. Aegean Pizza, near the Airport Rotary on Barnstable Road, will close on Saturday. The pizza shop also serves calzones, hot and cold subs, pasta, salads, fried chicken, and seafood. We're sad. It makes it harder when you see the reactions from the customers, said Maynor Cote, who co-owns Aegean Pizza with her husband, Vilson Cote. All we've been doing for 22 years is this business. The small white building with a dark blue awning is adjacent to Walgreens and Starbucks in the airport shopping center, which includes Staples, TJ Maxx, Ocean State Job Lot, Subway, Laundromat, Golf for Less, and Beauty Pros. The plaza is owned by J&P Hyannis Trust, with Lewis and Vinios as trustee, according to the assessor's office. The same owner is also listed for the building that houses Aegean Pizza. Vinios could not be reached for comment on Wednesday. The space next to Aegean Pizza is now available for lease and used to be McGrath's Saloon and Sports Bar. An AMG Realty sign near the street announces new retail office coming soon. Maynor Cote said there are plans to redevelop the building, and they're going to make another strip mall just another building. They had heard discussions about transforming the space for a while and were told at the end of January that they would have to vacate the property by Saturday. She said the business does not yet have a new space secured and would like to stay in Hyannis. They plan to hold on to the Aegean Pizza phone number for several months so they can be reached if necessary, and will advertise when a new location is known so their customers can find them. "We are humbled to have them as our customers and hope to see them again," said Maynor Cote. Whale study offers menopause answers, evolutionary trait still considered a mystery. By Elizabeth Wise of USA Today. The existence of menopause in humans has long been a biological conundrum, but scientists are getting a better understanding from a surprising source, whales. Findings of a new study suggest menopause gives an evolutionary advantage to grandmother whales' grandchildren. It's a unique insight because very few groups of animals experience menopause. A paper published Wednesday in the journal Nature looked at a total of 32 whale species, five of which undergo menopause. The findings could offer clues about why humans, the only land-based animal that also goes through menopause, evolved the trait. "They've done a great job of compiling all the evidence," said Michael Gervin, a professor of anthropology at the University of California in Santa Barbara, who studies human evolution and societies. "This paper, quite elegantly, gets at these very difficult issues. Whales might seem very distant from humans, but they have important similarities. Both are mammals, both long-lived, and both live in family and social groups that help each other. Studying these toothed whale species offers a way to think about human evolution," said Gervin. "In five species of toothed whales, killer whales, beluga whales, narwhals, short-finned pilot whales, and false killer whales, the researchers' findings suggest menopause evolved so grandmothers could help their daughters' offspring without competing with them for mates. Only daughters' offspring are aided because in these whales, while the males stay with their family group, they mate with females in other groups. But mothers do tend to give more support to their male offspring than their female offspring. Post-reproductive age females help their family group in many ways. Off the coast of Washington State and British Columbia in Canada, grandmother killer whales catch salmon and then break the fish in half and share that catch with their families. So they're actively feeding their families," said Darren Croft, a professor of behavioral ecology at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom and senior author on the paper. "The whale grandmothers also store ecological knowledge about when and where to find food in times of hardship, by using the experience they have gained over the lifetime of their environments. We see just the same patterns in human hunter-gatherer societies," said Croft. "In times of a drought or during times of social conflict, the people would turn to the elders of that community. They would have the knowledge." The researchers' findings support what's known as the grandmother hypothesis. It states that menopause is evolutionarily useful because while older women are no longer able to have children, they can instead focus their efforts on supporting their children and grandchildren. This means their family lines are more likely to survive, which has the same effect as having more children. "What we showed is that species with menopause have a much longer time spent to live with their grand offspring, giving them many more opportunities for intergenerational health due to their long life," said Samuel Ellis, an expert in human social behavior at the University of Exeter and the paper's first author. "The difference in humans," said Gervin, is that both grandmothers and grandfathers contribute to the well-being of their children and grandchildren. In the human story, I think it's multi-generational cooperation on steroids, he said. While the study doesn't prove once and for all that the grandmother hypothesis is the reason for menopause in women, it does lay out the evidence, he said. It's part of the story, but no one would say it tells the whole story, said Gervin. There are two proposed pathways for how menopause evolved in humans, the live-long hypothesis and the stop-early hypothesis. The live-long hypothesis suggests menopause increased total lifespan, but not how long a woman could have children. That leads to a prediction that species with menopause would live longer, but have the same reproductive lifespan as species without menopause. In the stop-early hypothesis, the theory is that menopause evolved by shortening the reproductive lifespan while the total lifespan remains unchanged. For this to be true, it would be likely that similar species without menopause would have the same lifespan as those that have menopause, but a shorter reproductive lifespan. In looking at species of toothed whales that don't have menopause, and five that do, the researchers' findings make the long life hypothesis seem more likely. We've been able to do shows that females minimize this competition over reproduction by not also lengthening their reproductive period. Instead, they've evolved a longer lifespan while keeping a shorter reproductive lifespan, Croft said. This appears to be exactly what humans did. The similarity with humans are not across the board, which is good news for men. No one knows why in humans only females undergo menopause, even though both sexes live to be approximately the same ages. That's not the case in some of these whale species, where male lifespans are typically much shorter than females. In the killer whale population, for example, females regularly live into their 60s and 70s, said Croft. The males are all dead by 40. More Eyes, Scrutiny for Growing Women's Hoops by Pete Iacobelli of the Associated Press, Dateline, Greenville, South Carolina. More eyes, more fans, and more scrutiny. The good and the bad of the game has all come into sharper focus as women's college basketball continues to grow in popularity. What fans saw Sunday in the Southeastern Conference Tournament Championship was number one South Carolina and LSU getting into a late-game confrontation that led to multiple ejections. Chippy play, plenty of trash-talking, and players thrown out, something more familiar to fans watching an NBA game. I just don't want the people who are tuning into women's basketball to see that and think that this is our game, because it isn't, said South Carolina coach Dawn Staley, who apologized to the crowd and in post-game interviews. Our game is a really beautiful thing. Not always. Earlier this season, Ohio State fans were criticized for a court-storming incident where Iowa star Caitlin Clark collided with a fan rushing to celebrate. Last year, Clark and LSU star Angel Reese's trash-talking in the national championship game surprised fans who may not know that the women's game has plenty of that, just as it has hard fouls and rough-and-tumble play. Last November, the NCAA said it was putting a new emphasis on sportsmanship after last season saw a 33% increase in technical fouls, including a 77% increase on techs given to head coaches and a whopping 193% increase on technical fouls assessed to personnel on the bench. Ejections were way up, and there were at least two prominent on-court fights. A month ago, five players were ejected during a game between Southern Miss and Arkansas State, but that was an under-the-radar game. The LSU-South Carolina skirmish happened in front of 13,163 screaming fans at the Bone Secure Wellness Arena, and many more watching on ESPN. We've reached the halfway point of our program, and regular listeners are aware that at this point of our broadcast, we move to the obituaries. The first obituary today is for Pearl Simpson, Dateline Sandwich. Pearl Augusta Simpson, age 95 of Sandwich, passed away peacefully on March 10th at her home, surrounded by her family. She was born to Harold and Corinne Conrad Wenzel. Pearl was the wife of the late Howard Simpson, whom she was married to for 62 years. Pearl grew up in Brockton and graduated from Brockton High School and the Brockton Hospital School of Nursing, where she obtained her degree. She continued to work at Brockton Hospital for her entire nursing career of 42 years. Upon their retirement, she and her late husband moved to Sandwich, where they spent many happy years on the Cape. She enjoyed traveling with her late husband, spending time in Florida as well as trips to Alaska, Hawaii, and Europe. She was an avid reader and loved her crossword puzzles. She also enjoyed many activities at her church, including Bible study, exercise class, the lunch bunch, and choir. She was devoted to her family most of all. She is survived by her daughters, Jeanette and Joanne. Her most treasured great-grandsons, Jared Jackson and Aiden. She also leaves behind two sisters, Carolyn of Hyannis and Joyce of Mashpee, as well as a brother, Russell of East Wareham. She is preceded by her brothers, Roger and Gordon. A memorial service will be held at First Church, UCC on Main Street in Sandwich, on Tuesday, March 19th at 11 a.m., with a reception starting at 10 a.m. Donations can be made to the First Church UCC in her memory. Arrangements are being handled by Nickerson Bourne Funeral Home on Route 6A in Sandwich. Gail Marie Mott Smithson, Dateline Brewster. Gail Marie Mott Smithson, age 76, of Brewster, former owner of Bassett Wild Animal Farm, passed away on Wednesday, March 6th, surrounded by her loved ones. She was the wife of Donald G. Smithson, with whom she shared 59 years of marriage. She is survived by her husband Donald and her granddaughter Kaylee Marie, her sisters, several nieces and nephews, and other family members. She was predeceased by her daughter Denise and her son Dana. Visiting hours will be held at the Doan Beal and Ames Funeral Home on Route 134 in South Dennis on Sunday, March 17th from 2 to 5 p.m. Burial will take place at a later date that will be updated on the funeral home's website. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to the Animal Rescue League of Boston, the Brewster Branch. For the complete obituary, please visit the website of Doan Beal and Ames in Dennis. Florence Green Emerson, Dateline Ann Arbor. Florence E. Emerson, passed February 4th. Husband George Emerson, deceased 1989. Florence is survived by Colin Rhett Eden Anthony. Grandchildren, Jared Tyler Guerin, Amelia, and Natalia. Born July 2nd, 1938. Many in U.S. don't have home insurance, by Betty Lynn Fisher of USA Today. More than 6 million homeowners nationwide do not carry homeowners insurance, putting them at extreme risk in the event of natural disasters or other significant damage to their homes, a new study has found. The study by the Consumer Federation of America found that uninsured property accounts for 7.4% of all properties in the country, and leaves $1.6 trillion in property value unprotected. Being uninsured poses a potential threat not only to individual homeowners, but also to communities and our national housing stock, the Consumer Federation of America said in Exposed, a report on $1.6 trillion of uninsured American homes. Many consumers are struggling to afford rising premiums and must go without homeowners insurance, said Sharon Cornelison, the Consumer Federation of America's Director of Housing and co-author of the report. That puts them at risk of losing everything. One storm or wildfire means they have to go into deep financial debt to repair their home, live with unsafe and inadequate housing, or even become homeless. The report notes that lack of homeowners insurance disproportionately impacts Hispanic, Black, and Native American homeowners. Over time, insurance access is likely to become a key decider of who can fully reap the benefits of homeownership, including maintaining their home and building wealth, the report said. Findings in the study, which was an analysis of 2021 American Housing Survey data from the U.S. Census Bureau, included 1 in 13 American homeowners living in about 6.1 million homes are uninsured. Homeowners earning under $50,000 per year are twice as likely to lack insurance than homeowners in general. Among lower-income homeowners, 15% are without coverage. Certain demographics are disproportionately at risk. 22% of Native American homeowners, 14% of Hispanic homeowners, and 11% of Black homeowners have no insurance. Rural homeowners, those living in metropolitan areas of Houston and Miami, and homeowners in Mississippi, New Mexico, and Louisiana are most likely to be uninsured. The Consumer Federation of America has several recommendations, including state insurance regulators should collect more data to track homeowners' insurance gaps and inequalities in insurance markets. States and the federal government need to substantially increase investments in community risk reduction, home fortification, and loss mitigation, and develop strategies to reduce insurers' over-reliance on unregulated global reinsurance. That is the coverage that insurance companies purchase to offload some of the risk they assume for their policyholders. Today's Ask Carolyn column is headlined, Expectant Parent Overcome by Anxiety from Past Pregnancy Losses. Carolyn Hacks is away. The following column first appeared on February 10, 2010. Dear Carolyn, we recently found out that my wife is pregnant. It will be our first child. This is usually joyous news, and while I'm elated, I'm also terrified. This is her third pregnancy. The last two ended in miscarriage. Both times we were devastated, and while it's unspoken, I think this is our last shot at it. We're both in our late 30s and have been at it now for more than 2 years. The problem is our combined stress. I'm nervous all the time about the pregnancy. Losing sleep, asking a million times a day, do you feel sick? Are your breasts sore? Are you tired? Etc. Basically making sure she still feels pregnant. It's starting to get to her. She is, of course, nervous too. She has experienced all the pain and the physical manifestation of the loss. I was just there for the awful ride. She believes, rightfully so, that I need to be strong for both of us this time around. Easier said than done, however, as every time she seems peppy, hungry, or not sore, I fear the worst is about to happen again. Any advice so I can maybe at least fake some strength here? Signed, Not So Strong in D.C. Dear Not So Strong in D.C., first of all, congratulations. This is joyous news. You're prepared for it to take a devastating turn, I understand. But expecting bad news will neither prevent the bad news from happening nor make it hurt less if it comes. Please remind yourself of this often, particularly when you're about to ask your wife how she feels. Do you feel sick, etc., isn't making anything sure. You're merely finding out if she still feels pregnant, and that's a very different thing. Please internalize the obvious. None of your questions have any positive effect on the pregnancy itself. And while that might feel like torture, i.e. helplessness to prevent the worst, try seeing it instead as liberating. You are under no pressure to make this work. It's not up to you anymore. That frees you to concentrate on what you can do. You can buy and prepare healthy foods, keep up with the laundry, plan diverting, as in distracting, things for you and your wife to do. Catch movies or exhibits or games, hike local trails, see friends. You can take on house projects that aren't baby-specific, but that would be useful preparations like building shelves and cleaning out closets. In other words, give yourself a definitive education on what you can and can't control, and then put that education to work. Get your hands and mind occupied with something other than things beyond your control, like the minute-by-minute fluctuations of your wife's physical state. If this proves to be impossible, then get outside help with your anxiety and grief. Either way, you can get your spirit engaged in something more positive and productive, too. Say to yourself privately, and to your wife aloud, "We'll be okay," because you will, no matter what happens with the pregnancy, as long as you take good care of each other through this. Texas man who used iron lung for decades dies. Alexander contracted polio as a child, by Jamie Stengel of the Associated Press. Dateline, Dallas. A Texas man who spent most of his 78 years using an iron lung chamber and built a large following on social media, recounting his life from contracting polio in the 1940s to earning a law degree, has died. Paul Alexander died Monday at a Dallas hospital, said Daniel Spinks, a longtime friend. He said Alexander had recently been hospitalized after being diagnosed with COVID-19, but did not know the cause of death. Alexander was 6 when he began using an iron lung, a cylinder that encased his body as the air pressure in the chamber forced air into and out of his lungs. In recent years, he had millions of views on his TikTok account called Conversations with Paul. "He loved to laugh," Spinks said. "He was just one of the bright stars of this world." Alexander told the Dallas Morning News in 2018 that he was powered by faith, and that what drove his motivation to succeed was his late parents, whom he called magical and extraordinary souls. "They just loved me," he told the newspaper. "They said, 'You can do anything,' and I believed it." The newspaper reported that Alexander was left paralyzed from the neck down by polio, and operated a plastic implement in his mouth to write emails and answer the phone. Alexander earned a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Texas in 1978, and a law degree from the school in 1984. Polio was once one of the nation's most feared diseases, with annual outbreaks causing thousands of cases of paralysis. It mostly affects children. Vaccines became available starting in 1955, and a national vaccination campaign cut the annual number of U.S. cases to fewer than 100 in the 1960s and fewer than 10 in the 1970s, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 1979, polio was declared eliminated in the U.S., meaning it was no longer routinely spread. Rent a book or DVD anytime with Osterville Library's Auto Lend Machine, by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. The Osterville Village Library is bringing books, DVDs, and other library materials to the people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with their new AutoLend library machine. Thanks to the machine, Clam's cardholders on the Cape and Islands have access to 250 library materials any time of day, regardless of whether the library is open or closed. "It's an instant, on-demand world," said Cindy Cotton, executive director of the Osterville Village Library. "We're hopefully trying to address that." Clam's cardholders scan their library card and browse through the options of books, DVDs, and other materials stocked within the machine. Once they've come to a decision, users select the Borrow Item button on the screen, and the machine finds the selected item. The concept is similar to Redbox. Once found, the door opens, the user takes their item, and is taken to a screen asking if they'd like a receipt. Once an option is selected, the item is checked out and users are free to take their item with them. "We don't live in a 9-to-5 world anymore," Cindy Cotton, director of the library, said. "Everything's changed. If we're closed on a holiday, or you get down late, or you're working the overnight shift, having that accessibility is so important. Once finished with your item, or when it's time to return it to the library, users can return their items through the machine as well. Materials checked out at the AutoLend Library do not have to be returned to the Osterville Village Library, however. They just have to be returned to a Clam's library. If you came over from the islands for the day, you could grab a book and you could bring it back to the library on the islands," Cotton said. The library is still setting up the machine to have materials organized by genre and allow CLAMS members to place holds on library items through the AutoLend Library. Cotton says she hopes to make the machine useful for all CLAMS cardholders. "We're still learning about it," she said. "People can use it right now. We're going to keep rolling out new things. We're not going to overwhelm the public or ourselves with different things until we're ready to do it and make it rewarding for everybody. The library is on Wiano Avenue in Osterville. For more information about the AutoLend Library, visit the Osterville Library's website. Falmouth Winter Farmers Market, Nice Way to Spend a Sunday Afternoon, by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. Inside St. Barnabas' Episcopal Church's Great Hall, tables, vendors, and eager customers occupy the space. From table to table, goods differ. On one, a selection of goat milk soaps and alpaca socks and scarves overflow. On another, farm fresh produce, such as bunches of carrots and radishes, cover the foldaway. The hall is the new home of the Falmouth Farmers Market's Winter Market, which runs from noon to 3 every Sunday, besides Easter Sunday, until April 14th. It's been a nice way to spend a winter Sunday afternoon, said Lindsay Close, president of the market's board of directors. While the summer market has run for several years, the winter market is a relatively new addition. The market launched last year operating out of a greenhouse at Green Dragon Farm. The community really came out, Close said. The vendors and farmers were excited. It just had a great community feel and supported that we really do need to have local access to local food throughout the year and not just in the summertime. For this year, the market secured a new home inside St. Barnabas' Great Hall and has seen a steady flow of customers throughout the week. Typically, around 18 vendors from on and off Cape set up shop inside the hall, selling a variety of goods from fresh produce and farm-raised meats to flowers, sweets, and soaps. According to Close, they keep to vendors within a 100-mile radius of Falmouth. The right mix of vendors for shopping. If you're going somewhere, you don't want to have just all flowers, Close said. It would be lovely, but you want to be able to pick up some bread, seafood for dinner, and some vegetables to go with that seafood. Curating that right mix of vendors so you don't have too many vendors of one type and you have most of the things that shoppers are looking for. For shoppers, Close noted that the produce is different in the winter than in the summer. In summer, shoppers are spoiled with in-demand fruits and vegetables that are harder to grow due to the climate. We have a lot of greens that are grown in the greenhouse, Close said. There's kale, salad greens, those sorts of things. There's carrots, potatoes, the colder crops. We definitely have the challenge of being in a New England ecosystem where we don't have fresh peppers or tomatoes, but we do still have delicious local greens. At its market on March 10th, vendors varied in product and experience as returning sellers and newcomers to the market prepared for the day ahead. For Amy Bradford, owner of 1780 Farmhouse, a Middleboro sweet shop, this winter market marks her first time participating in the Falmouth Farmers Market. I'm hoping people just come out to support local farmers and grab little goodies to take home and enjoy, she said. It's just a really fun time. Her products of the day were a variety of flavors of small batch toffees and her fan favorite salted caramels. I usually have 4 to 6 flavors every market I do, she said of her toffee. I'm also very well known for my salted caramel. Next door to her, Cape Coop Farm, based in East Falmouth, filled its table with a mix of farm fresh eggs, alpaca products, handmade goat's milk soaps, and other spa products. For Liz Martin, owner of Cape Coop Farm, the importance of hosting local markets is clear to support local businesses. It's super important, especially in the winter where the Cape is such a seasonal business, Martin said. The winter farmers market is a place for small businesses to interact with the customers and have a little storefront where they can meet their customers in the off months, she said. Rebecca Scanlon, owner of Pleasant Lake Farm in Harwich, said farmers markets help keep them in business and give consumers a chance to buy locally grown organic meats and produce. If you go to the store, I'm losing out, she said. It's keeping our economy alive on Cape Cod when people buy from all our local businesses. As a certified organic farmer, Scanlon said her goods are held to a much higher standard than those you might find at the grocery store. Health-wise, the locally raised meat she produces is all hormone antibody-free, she said. It's also about the humane treatment of the animals. They're much healthier, they're grass-fed, and well-loved. Vegetables, the same thing. It's a very different style of growing. No fertilizers unless it's approved by the Bay State Organic Certifiers. Everything has to be approved by them, Scanlon said. The market provides the opportunity to sell healthy foods through its vendors, but also through its practices. While accepted payment methods vary from vendor to vendor, every vendor accepts SNAP EBT. Through a partnership with Sustainable Cape, the market gives a $10 fruit and vegetable credit to SNAP users. These purchases also help SNAP users earn money back through the Massachusetts Healthy Initiative Program. We feel it's really important that this fresh local food is available to everybody, regardless of income, Close said. We really work to make that available to our neighbors that are on SNAP. The Healthy Incentive Program, known as HIP, ensures that money is placed back onto customers' EBT cards, a monthly cap of $40, $60, or $80, when they use SNAP to buy fruits and vegetables from HIP-certified farm vendors, like the Falmouth Farmers Market, according to program materials online. It's really cool because the farmers get the money directly rather than going through a grocery store chain where it ends up in megacorporations' pockets. Jen Christian, manager of the summer market and one of three volunteer managers of the winter market. This bonus is only fruits and vegetables. We love the program and our market is really popular because we like to tell everybody about those programs. The Falmouth Farmers Market Winter Market runs from noon to 3 every Sunday, excluding Easter, until April 14th at St. Barnabas Episcopal Church on Main Street in Falmouth. Celebrate Women in the Arts with the Sandwich Arts Alliance by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. In honor of Women's History Month, the Sandwich Arts Alliance is hosting Celebrating Women in the Arts by Women, for Women, About Women, a weekend-long celebration of female artists. This is our first time doing this, said Melinda Gallant, a member of the Sandwich Arts Alliance's board of directors and coordinator for the Performing Arts Group. We hope we have good attendance, obviously, but we want to make this an annual event. We want people to know in Sandwich that we have a lot of women in Sandwich. They're doing great things in the arts, and this is our way of focusing on them, highlighting them, and applauding them for what they do. The weekend consists of four events: a reception for the exhibition Women in the Arts on March 15th, a Women in Music concert and performance from Fat Ass Cancer Bitch Christine Ernst on March 16th, and a scripted reading of Face East, a play from Woods Hole playwright Bronwyn Prosser on March 17th. The reception takes place at 5 p.m. on March 15th, kicking off the weekend's festivities. The exhibit consists of works from female members of the Alliance. Light refreshments will be served, and harpist Katie Coughlin will be playing throughout the evening. An award ceremony will also be held for those selected by judges as the best in show for several categories. On March 16th, the Women in Music concert begins at 2 p.m., featuring three musicians: Diana DeGioia, Shannon Davis, and Leslie Gage, performing a mix of original works and covers encompassing several genres, such as rock, jazz, and pop, and a conversation about songwriting. I liken it to why Taylor Swift writes her songs, Gallant said. It's about their songs, why they write them, and how they write them. Following the concert, Ernst takes the Old Glass Town stage at 7 p.m. to perform her one-woman show, Lucky 13. The show pokes fun at the ups and downs of life, reminding us all we can't take everything so seriously. She's poignant, she's funny, and man, does she hit the nail on the head sometimes, Gallant said about Ernst. Audience members will receive a cookie and a magnet as a souvenir following the show and be able to chat with Ernst as well. Closing out the weekend's celebrations is a scripted reading of Face East, a comedic coming-of-age play about a young woman trying to find her purpose while living in her childhood treehouse in her parents' backyard, directed by Nina Schussler, at 2 p.m. on March 17th. When asked about the importance of uplifting women in the arts, especially during Women's History Month, Gallant said she feels it's a difficult time for women in our current political and social climate, and it's imperative that we emphasize the multifaceted women's talents that women have. Women are kind of being ostracized or being pigeonholed, she said. Some rights are being taken away, and I don't care what your beliefs are about various things, but I think it's very important. I mean, we have a month given to us, right? International Women's Month, that now is the time to highlight what women do here on Cape Cod. All events will be held at the Sandwich Arts Alliance Center, located at the historic Sandwich Town Hall on Main Street. Admission to the Women in Arts Exhibition and the Women in Music Concert is free. A free will $5 donation will be collected following the concert, and tickets for Lucky 13 and Face East are $25. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit the Sandwich Arts Alliance website. We want younger women and high school girls and men and women and everybody in between to come to this and see just how much talent we have right here in Sandwich, Gallant said. Other fun happening on Cape this weekend. In collaboration with the Law Enforcement Torch Run, the Harwich Police Department is hosting its annual Polar Plunge in support of the Special Olympics Massachusetts at 11 a.m. on March 16th at Red River Beach in Harwich. Participants can join online at the Special Olympics Massachusetts website. On-site registration and check-in begins at 10 a.m., and participants under 18 must have a parent or guardian present to sign a waiver. Waivers can be downloaded online prior to the plunge. Stephen G. Walker talks about a moving meditation, life on a Cape Cod kettle pond in Osterville. You may not see them on a map, but dotted around the Cape are kettle ponds, small bodies of fresh water formed by glaciers thousands of years ago. In his latest book, A Moving Meditation, Life on a Cape Cod Kettle Pond, local author Stephen G. Waller provides an in-depth look at the history and ecosystem of one of the many Centerville's long pond. Waller will discuss the topics touched on in his new book during a lecture at 1 p.m. on March 16th at the Osterville Village Library. The event is free to attend, but attendees are asked to register with Amy Wolf, Manager of Programming Services and Patron Planning for the Osterville Village Library. You can call the library at 508-420-0550. It's located on Wiano Avenue in Osterville. Spring Ring 2024 at the Harwich Community Center. The 9th Cape Cod Spring Ring Concert is set to take place at 2 p.m. on March 16th at the Harwich Community Center. The show, directed by Raleigh Ringers Artistic Director David Harris, features 75 handbell ringers from across New England. Pieces will be performed harmoniously under Harris's direction, plus a few pieces will be performed by each participating choir. The show is free to attend, but a free will donation will be collected at the end. The Harwich Community Center is located on Oak Street in Harwich. Try a plant-based recipe at book signing by Cape Cod Healthcare's Dr. Kumara Siddhartha. In celebration of his new book, All My Secrets, Messages of Health from Your Body Decoded, Chief Health Equity and Wellness Officer for Cape Cod Healthcare, Dr. Kumara Siddhartha, is hosting a book signing, presentation, and Q&A at 11:30 a.m. on March 17th at Friendship Hall, part of Unity on Cape Cod. Guests will be able to try one of the 30 recipes outlined in Dr. Siddhartha's book and ask questions about the book, plant-based eating, and any other health-related topics. The event is free to attend and is presented by the Earth Care Ministry team at Unity on Cape Cod, located at 147 Walton Avenue in Hyannis. And that's all I have time for today. This is your reader, Libby, saying thank you for listening.